This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. It is week one in the NFL. Look, we know this. We know that in the end, NFL teams, the difference between bad teams in this league and good teams in this league is pretty thin. We know that. We keep saying it all the time. Sometimes we don't believe it, though. That's one of the problems. We're all human. So we all have this sort of idea that we think in the end the game should go this way because I see the talent here and the talent on this side is a little bit more hidden. And I think in the end that this is going to be a game in which Team A really wallops Team B. And those are hard to predict. You know, if you think about the Philadelphia Eagles, when we did our preview of the Eagles, it was this amazingly complete football team that was coming off a tough Super Bowl loss, a game they should have won. And they're going to come into this season and laser focused on the goal at hand. And that's absolutely still true. Obviously, week one for everybody is not a season ender. And then there was the Patriots, year three with Mac Jones, another new offensive coordinator. They bring back Bill O'Brien, and now Jones is trying to keep his job, try to focus in on being the guy that is going to be the Patriots quarterback for years and years and years. And oh, by the way, they're honoring Tom Brady, et cetera, et cetera. The Eagles get out to a 16-0 lead. Now, if you were just sort of casually flipping through the games, you might not go back to that one for a bit, feeling like the Eagles have been, you know, controlling this one comfortably. But the Patriots came back. And not only did the Patriots come back, they had an opportunity to take the lead in that game late, and they did not do so. That was a much closer game than people may have thought, especially given 16-0. And then there were some games yesterday where it absolutely went in the opposite direction that most people had. The Buccaneers, this season, well, they're kind of a mess. Baker Mayfield is starting quarterback. And they went to Minnesota, a team that won 13 games last year, albeit through a very, very small margins. In fact, they had a negative point differential. They were a 13-win season with a negative point differential. And yet the Tampa Bay Buccaneers went on the road and beat them. The team that really surprised me, though, yesterday were the Rams. Who's playing for the Rams that's catching footballs? How did they execute 5 scoring drives? How did they outgain Seattle 426-180? Yeah, they have Aaron Donald. Cooper Kupp, though, on the IR. Matt Stafford throwing everybody. Yeah, that was an impressive performance. That was a game that I thought, you know, here's Seattle, a playoff team, wanting to showcase that they're one of the better teams in the NFC, and Sean McVay had more in store for them than maybe he thought. I know I was talking earlier about the Steelers, and I thought they'd actually put up a fight, and they did not. I'm not really surprised that the 49ers were great. The 49ers are great. But again, we know this about the National Football League, and that it does... You know, I was talking to my son over the weekend, and he hit, for some reason, he's trapped in conversations with his college buddies on which college team could beat an NFL team. And they're hung up on the 2001 Miami Hurricanes because that team was loaded with NFL talent. And I'm trying to get him, because he's making the argument that wouldn't happen, and I'm trying to get him to understand that you're not talking about an apples-to-apples comparison, even if the sport's the same. So many times when we see a bad NFL team, we think that they're players that don't belong in the league, that they were, you know, just a ragtag bunch of guys that were put together locally, when that's not the case at all. Most players on bad football teams could easily play for teams that are very, very good. It's that it's coaching, it's matchups, it's very, very slim. And when you watch a college team dominate another college team, you're not seeing them demolish a level that NFL teams are going through week in and week out. It's one of the reasons Urban Meyer, like many college coaches who have come before, you know, come before him, have said the same thing. There is no break on the schedule. You better be taking every opponent seriously. You better be taking everybody on your, no matter where they are, maybe what talent level they have, especially in week one, where a team can find a little bit of momentum. Now, I don't know how many people yesterday would have looked and said, you know, Jacksonville Jaguars will need two late touchdowns to get away from Anthony Richardson and the Jaguars. And the Colts, I should say. I don't know how many people thought that the Washington Commanders, even though they're not a good football team, would be in a legit dogfight against a team that was presumed to be tanking this season and not having a head coach that was in over his head without Kyler Murray at quarterback. The Commanders need also two late scores in the fourth quarter to pull themselves away from the Arizona Cardinals. Now, Washington is not the Buffalo Bills. Washington is not the Philadelphia Eagles or the Kansas City Chiefs. But it just, again, goes to show you how tough these games are, how tough these games are to predict. Even when you get the team that wins and you think they're going to win, how many of you think they win the way they win, whether it's a close game or last night's game, in which the Cowboys win 40-0? 40-0 on the road. And oh, by the way, if you're not paying attention, that is 12 of 13 meetings that Dallas has beaten the New York Giants. That is a rivalry within the division that is completely going one way. So that, like week one, there were a couple of eye-opening games like that. The Denver Broncos. All right, now, the Denver Broncos were a big story going into this season because it was year two with Russell Wilson, but it was year one of Sean Payton. And Sean Payton was going to have to get the team's act together. And he was going to have to turn Russell Wilson into the high-level quarterback they're paying him to be. Remember, he's under contract with the Broncos until 2028. So it is more about finding the coach that knows how to work with a quarterback that has been a Pro Bowler rather than finding a new young guy to take over the team. They had tried that with two other guys, and then they tried it with Vic Fangio, who had been in the league 30 years as a defensive coordinator. But in the end, Russell Wilson was effective, but not quite effective enough. He was 27 of 34, short passes, 177 yards, and two touchdowns. But when they needed that team to score the most in the second half, they were held to one field goal. So there is some work to still do in Denver. But Wilson didn't play terribly. He did have that one fumble that was called back because it was a penalty on the Raiders, which I kind of chuckled at. Because I thought, you know, don't shoot yourself. Sometimes the Broncos will do that for you. You don't have to kill any sort of potential goodwill. And Jimmy Garoppolo, he threw for 200 yards on 20 completions with two touchdowns. So it was a game in which it was very, very tight. The Broncos just came up short. But that was my big question going into this game, was how good could Russell Wilson be effective? But it was two touchdowns in the first half and then nothing after that.
Yeah, I don't think it's a definitive moment. I don't think, you know, the marriage between Sean Payton and Russell Wilson is going to work out.
No.
There's looking at it going, there's nothing to see here.
Yeah, not yet. Not yet. There might be something, but not Sunday. It did look like that early. The two touchdown passes he threw were very, very crisp.
Yeah, we can sit back today and go, hey, you know, the Broncos are alone in first place.
That's right. Oh, you know who was really impressive this weekend was Bijan Robinson of the Atlanta Falcons.
Yeah, I think that might have
really
been a good pickup.
That was a very nice pick.
You
don't want to go with running backs in the first round, right? They'd take Bijan Robinson. And he's effective out of the backfield. He runs the ball great, but he caught the most passes in this Arthur Smith offense of anybody yesterday, and he had a touchdown.
Yeah,
Tyler Algier,
a very nice
is
one
their
too.
Main
I
running
mean, he,
back, but Bijan Robinson's great.
Yeah, I don't know who he juked.
Yeah.
There, but that guy, you know, I think is now in witness protection.
That's right. Yeah. Boy, he really went right between two guys. Just spun right out of two guys. It was
great. Just stopped on a dime and then just exploded forward. And you look at that going, okay, this guy, we're going to have some fun with him.
Frank Schwab made a point on Twitter, Frank Schwab of Yahoo Sports, that, you know, Trevor Lawrence had some beautiful touchdowns yesterday against the Colts. He's going to be slinging it all season long. That pass he threw to Zay Jones, where Zay Jones in stride, diving for it and grabbing it, great, great little toss.
Really amazing what a good coach can do.
Right. It really is. It really is. And I'm not unlocking the guy that we believed was going to be an NFL superstar.
It really, I mean, it's almost unfair that we have to consider his first season in the records.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad, and I'm glad Urban Meyer landed on his feet perfectly doing Wendy's commercials and being on the Fox Noon kickoff.
Of course.
That's the beautiful thing about sports is that no matter what you do and no matter how controversial you may be, you can land yourself on television. It all works out. Like, has there ever been an athlete that has ever said, high-profile athlete has ever said, you know, I regret doing all that stuff. It ruined my life. Look at me now. I have nothing. Nobody talks to me. No, there's always a TV agent going, I got you. Don't worry. Don't worry. Yeah. Leave this. Quit playing.
I guess,
get on one of these argue shows, whatever it may be.
Did Manziel kind of do that?
Manziel kind of did that, yeah, I guess.
But not really. He didn't go full board on it.
He's very, very nice house in Arizona.
No, he wouldn't change a thing. Are you kidding me?
No, he's fine. He's fine. And I'm sure there were offers to do something.
Oh, yeah.
For Johnny Manziel.
Yeah.
Yeah, Urban Meyer's in his sunglasses in Boulder going, yeah, I think the second half, the Buffaloes will open it up a little bit. Wink, wink. Get back to the thing you know, because NFL football was definitely not something you knew.
Yep. I got to get back to my restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, yeah, Bijan Robinson had a very good day yesterday. Trevor Lawrence looked pretty sharp.
Yeah.
The rookie quarterbacks did go 0-3 yesterday.
Yeah, but,
so,
you know,
yeah,
I will say this. Anthony Richardson did not look that bad.
No, he didn't look that bad. No,
and
he did not look that bad.
For C.J. Stroud to complete his first pass to C.J. Stroud is pretty impressive.
Pretty cool. That is pretty cool. Good, the bad, and the dumb coming up. And then we're going to talk to Jared Dubin about his thoughts on week one in the NFL when we continue.
Wake Up Call continues now on the SportsMap Radio Network.
Time for the good.
That's really nice.
The bad.
That's the bad guy.
And the dumb.
What an idiot. Oh, what a loser.
All right, the good, the bad, and the dumb. Week one in the NFL. Let's get right to it. The good of the day.
Good of the day. I mean, there was plenty to choose from.
Right.
I mean, there was college football. A lot of great things happened there. NFL, you know, being back in our lives, full NFL schedule yesterday was great. But I will say this. I did take a break on Saturday from college football, and I put it on the U.S. Open.
I did, too.
And I know we briefly mentioned it, but, wow, that was exciting. Coco Gauff winning the U.S. Open.
It's awesome, especially when it's an American teenager, and you go, okay, cool, we've got the next one that's coming up that's going to be a factor in these things. You hope so. You hope so.
Because she's immediately the face of tennis in America now.
Yeah, right. Right. And even before, as it was when we were talking to our tennis guest, even before, it's like, I have friends who really, really, really watch tennis, and they love Coco Gauff. They've loved her for the last couple of years, and now she's a U.S. Open champion. So, good for her.
Yeah. I mean, youngest winner since Serena won it all way back in the day.
Yep.
It's the first major title for an American since 2020.
I know.
That's a long drought for us.
You got Tracy Austin and Chris Everett, the other two teenagers who won the U.S. Open. That's awesome. That's fantastic.
And, of course, I know everyone saw the viral video of her when she was 8 years old dancing at the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
Dancing to Call Me Maybe.
Right.
So, I mean, it was a great moment. Great moment watching her, you know, pull it off. I mean, she played really. I mean, she broke Sabalenka, and I was really nervous for her because Sabalenka took that timeout, that medical timeout. I was like, okay, right. is this a move to just disrupt her rhythm?
Yeah, slow down the momentum, disrupt the rhythm. Yeah, little tennis tactic.
And it did for that first game, but then Coco Gauff found her groove again and just congrats, Coco.
Yep, and then Novak Djokovic won the men's title for his 24th major.
Yeah.
So
lackluster. No, it's a huge deal. No, it's a huge
deal.
I mean, the thing is, I love his story. I just can't stand him.
Yeah, I don't like him, but still 24 majors is 24.
24 majors.
You know,
I'm not going to say relatively easy yesterday. I mean, he was hitting all the right shots and had complete control of the game, but at the same time, he was starting to show his age. And I did like what Medvedev...
Well, that's what's happening. That's what's going to happen. Like, enjoy it while you can, because he's going to be gone. And Alcaraz will be taking over. There'll be another Ben Shelton might be an emerging star.
I did appreciate Medvedev's comment. You know, when he took the mic, to congratulate Novak, and he just turned him and goes, "What are you still doing here?"
Right. Yeah. Still around. How old is Djokovic? 36?
Yeah, something like that.
36, 37? No, I guess it's just probably 36.
Yeah.
I think that's how old he is.
Old enough that, you know, these guys are looking at him like, come on, you've been here too long.
Yeah, it's been time.
I mean, what it reminds me of is the AFC quarterbacks in the 2000s.
Right.
It was the same three year in and year out over and over and over and over again. And it feels like that's how it is in tennis now.
Well, the thing about tennis is, like when you mentioned Coco Gauff dancing at the U.S. Open, right? We see that sometimes in other sports. We see, like, here's 8-year-old little leaguer Mike Trout.
Right.
He's at a Yankee game. Yay. But what makes those, like, 8-year-old Coco Gauff is that somebody already knew Coco Gauff was going to be a major tennis player. Like, somebody already, at that age, they already had her, like, she's going to be great. She's 8. She's already beating 12-year-olds.
Right.
Like that starts very young. You can take a little leaguer to a game, and he may go nowhere near being a Major League Baseball player.
Oh,
but there are 8-year-olds where they are in the pipeline, especially overseas. So the thing that happens in tennis is, if you really, really know tennis, is that a 36-year-old Novak Djokovic has been in your life probably 25 years. From his junior days, if you really know the sport and you follow the sport, even on that level, like they become 12-year-old, 13-year-old prodigies that you're watching, and then they're 36-year-old winning the U.S. Open, and you're like, "Holy cow! I've been around this guy for 28 years of his life since he was a little kid. I've been following his exploits on the junior circuit." And that's what you end up getting. So for a lot of tennis people, it feels even longer than us. You are just like, once every 4 years, we pay attention to the majors, and he's winning the majors. And for a lot of tennis people, it's like, no, I've been following this guy since he was 10, like 26, 27 years.
And I'm not surprised
knowing what this kid was, you know, hearing about this kid, hearing about this guy, et cetera, et cetera. Same thing with Coco Gauff. Like, I feel like I've been hearing about Coco Gauff for 6 or 7 years now.
Yeah, I think we have.
You know, and she's 19.
I think when she burst onto the scene, like when she was 15, 16 years old, playing at her first U.S. Open.
Right.
And playing well. And so, it's just now, it's just like, all right, you know, she finally made it. And she, because she was getting that stigma, it's like, hey, she's great. She just doesn't perform in the majors.
So, all right, what is the bad of the day?
The bad of the day. There was plenty to choose from. I could have gone to,
Steelers?
I could have gone to the Steelers. Could have gone to J.C. Jackson. I could have even went college and, we could have talked about a little bit about the Michigan State scenario that's going on.
Oh, yeah, Mel Tucker.
But the real bad for me was the Brewers holding the Yankees hitless for 10 and a third inning and then losing.
What is worse? Is it worse? When you're a pitcher and you lose a no-hitter, like you throw a no, like Andy Hawkins, so the Yankees threw a no-hitter and lost? Or is it worse when you're Corbin Burns and you throw eight innings. No-hit baseball, your reliever comes in, he throws an inning of no-hit baseball, but you didn't score enough runs to end the game like it should, and instead you go into extras where the Yankees' bats go, now we're back.
And but you go into extras where that pitcher, the first one, throws an inning of no-hit baseball.
He throws a no-hitting of baseball, and Sal Frederick is making a brilliant catch to preserve it.
Yes.
And Giancarlo Stanton, it's a two-run home run, and you go back and forth until Kyle Higashioka hits an RBI double, and the Yankees win it in 13 innings.
I mean, that's got...
horrible.
That's got to be... I don't even know what to... I mean, if you're the Brewers, I mean, do you even get on a plane?
How embarrassing.
At this point, it's like, I don't even want to go home.
Your pitcher is out there dealing. Like literally figure out something. Jump in front of a pitch and fake it. I don't care. Get on base. Figure out a way to get you. Corbin Burns is throwing a no-hitter, and you can't support him with one run. Can't do it. Yeah, that's sad. That's terrible.
Yeah. I think that's worse, than you know, if you threw a no hitter, but you still end up losing the game because you walked someone or something like that, you know.
Right. You figure out, like, thing. All right, I've given up two runs that are not my fault, but I still gave up two runs.
Errors happened, and, you know, a guy dropped the ball in the outfield, so it's still not a hit, but it's an error. You know, things like that could happen. But, yeah, you had three pitchers deliver no hit ball for 10 straight innings.
Unreal.
And you can't, like you said, I mean, it's there's no excuse for that.
And this is what happens, man. This is why going to the pen, sometimes not everybody has it. You know what I mean? Like, not everybody has what you're doing. And then you get a couple of guys, you're like, all right, they're doing good. And then the one guy goes, sorry.
But, I mean, they did have it. I mean, they went to the pen, and the guys were still delivering.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm looking, checking the box score right now. I mean, Garrett Cole gave up three hits, but one of those hits was a double. You mean to tell me, like, you couldn't get him around real quick? Just a simple slap.
And the Brewers have every right to go. How many innings did you think we were going to no hit them?
Right.
15? 16? Like, this is our fault at the plate.
Yeah.
Failed to deliver.
10 1/3. And that catch
Willie Adames, Tyrone Taylor.
That catch was amazing.
That was
That takes stones.
That was great.
That takes stones.
Freelick's catch, I think his name is.
Yeah, I mean, if you know you're going up against the wall, and you know you have your teammate is tracking the ball at the exact same speed as you, it's like I'm almost like I'd back off a little bit. But.
Yeah, too bad for the Brewers. They lost. They're in a tight race too with the Cubs for that division.
Yeah, so this is one they couldn't let get away.
Yeah, it's down to three games. So this is the stretch run where these games are really, really going to matter. So, all right, what is the no, we're going to do dumb coming up.
Yeah, we can do dumb coming up. We'll go back to the NFL because there was something said that was really dumb, and I'm really starting to feel bad for this guy.
Yeah. Let's go back to tennis real quick. Did you like Novak's Mamba Kobe Bryant t-shirt that he had yesterday at the end?
Yeah.
That was cool.
Yeah, you know, I mean, kind of fitting, I guess, because it was number 24. I did see, and it almost made the dumb of the day, the ESPN decided to award Novak Djokovic the Moderna shot of the day.
Oh, I noticed that, yeah. The Moderna shot of the day.
Moderna shot of the day. And
good Lord.
Yeah. If you don't know, Novak's been avoiding the Moderna shot day for quite some time now, for 3 years at least.
I have to admit, I like the apparel companies. Roger Federer had this too. Where you get a certain milestone, and then they make the number, they give you the gear,
right?
Like, break this out if you win.
Yeah.
Then like his entire team was in a white Lacoste shirt, a jacket with the number 24 on it. Yeah.
I'm curious. Do those get sent away if that doesn't happen?
Yeah. Do those go away? Do those go to third world country if that doesn't exist?
Where somebody still to this day thinks Buffalo is the greatest team ever?
Yeah. Or do they keep them in boxes for the Australian Open? Like, one day we'll get to open this. We'll see. Maybe.
This is Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, continuing to look at week one of the NFL, but we got the dumb of the day and the good, the bad, and the dumb. Jared Dubin, CBS Sports, will join us coming up in 15 minutes. We will talk to him about his thoughts on some of the action in yesterday's NFL games, including we'll also talk to him about tonight's game, Monday Night Football. All right, what is the dumb of the day?
The dumb of the day is I'm really, really, really starting to feel bad for this guy. And that guy that I'm speaking of is Matt Ryan.
Matt Ryan. I heard he had a bad day calling games yesterday.
It wasn't so much a bad day calling games. I mean, you know, he's no Tony Romo.
Right.
So let's just put that out there. But coming back from half, Andrew Catalan, alongside Tiki Barber and Matt Ryan, were in the booth. And this is what Andrew had to say coming out of the half. And they were broadcasting they were at the Vikings-Buccaneers game, okay?
Okay.
We were just chopping some burgers at halftime saying this game feels like it should be 28-3 in favor of Minnesota. Why is it still 10-10?
Turnovers.
I don't even know why he said that.
Why did he say that?
I mean, I understand where he was trying to go, that this game, you know, what he was trying to imply was that the Vikings should be up by a lot more than the Buccaneers. But he turned to Matt Ryan and goes, I feel like this game should be 28-3.
And all I could think about, is Matt Ryan will never. This is his legacy.
No.
Okay, so this is the. So this is the Matt Ryan, like, little dib at 28-3. I gotcha.
Yeah.
I gotcha. Do you think he did it on purpose?
Oh, definitely.
You think he did?
I think so, yes. I mean, come
28-3 is a common way, though, of
is it? Like,
well, I don't know. If you're thinking of a big score and a little score, you go with the little score would be 3. It's not 5. It wouldn't be 2. It wouldn't be 7.
I don't think.
Because if you're trying to, if you, all right. Pick a number that would indicate a small score without a touchdown.
Oh, no, no. I agree. It would be 3.
6. It would be 3. Now, think of a score that would indicate a lot of touchdowns, but not too many.
I think you're giving Andrew Catalan a lot of credit
right
now.
I do, too. But my question would be, why would he say 28-3? Why would he do that on purpose to his partner?
Because it's a synonymous number
of
with Matt Ryan.
Of course we know and why you, it is.
And it's probably floating in the subconscious, course, and I'm sitting next to 28-3 guy.
Of course we know that. But my point is, why would he say... Okay. If you had a friend, a business partner that was arrested for speeding at 120 miles an hour through a 35 mile an hour zone.
Okay.
And you were working with him on a daily basis. You were going on trips with him. You were presenting things with him. Would you bring up 120 miles an hour all the time? Would you just do it constantly in every conversation? Like, would you work 120 into every conversation, making it uncomfortable? Like, what we're saying is, what you're saying is, Andrew Catalan had no other way of doing it. He had to say it because Matt Ryan is associated with 28-3.
I'm saying,
why would he do that?
Because I think
you can't just say just because Matt Ryan is associated with 28-3. That's almost rude.
I think he was doing it to be humorous, and the joke fell flat.
Right, because Matt Ryan didn't quite get it.
No, Matt Ryan's probably heard them all and just went, turnovers.
Yeah.
You know, just I'm ignoring this.
Or Matt Ryan is brand new to the job and was laser focused on the answer.
Probably that.
Right.
Probably that. Probably afraid to, you know, it's like, oh, I don't want to make a mistake. I don't want, you know, I'm kind of wanting this gig because they get paid a lot of money to just sit there and call a game.
Let me just say this. Being in a game booth where you've got a bunch of things going on, 90% of jokes fall flat because you're not focused on that environment. Or how do I put it? You're not focused on that angle. Right?
Yeah, because I can say this. When you watch it on TV or you watch the video of it, whether on TikTok or Twitter or wherever you get your news from, Tiki Barber doesn't even react.
Right.
Tiki Barber just looks at the camera and smiles.
Because everybody just is focused on that. There's like you're Matt Ryan and you know you're getting asked a question. You're focused on the answer. You're broadcasting. Right?
Yeah, maybe they have something already talked about beforehand. It's like, hey, I'm going to ask you this. What's going to be your answer?
So when we come out, I'm going to ask you why you think this game is not going to be out there. He's very unlikely to recognize 28-3 in the context because he's focused on the answer, what he wants to give, given that it's his first NFL gig. So, but I don't know if Andrew Catalan wants to have a relationship with Matt Ryan where Matt Ryan is like, stop with the 28-3 jokes.
It's old. Been there, done that.
Yeah. But yeah.
It was first broadcast out of the gate and, you know, we get a 28-3 reference right away.
I'm telling you though, I'm not that far off. If you're trying to set the stage for a game where 21 is just too small, 35 is too much, 28 is an answer.
24-3, can you get away with that?
You could do 24-3. Yeah, you could do
27-3. How about that?
Yeah, probably. Probably. So, I think this is more Monday morning quarterbacking than purposely putting a number in there. Let's all be honest here. 28-3 in NFL world was a million years ago. I mean, we're going on to Super Bowl 58. That was Super Bowl 51. So it's not like it was yesterday. So it was a while ago. I don't know if Andrew Catalan did this on purpose. Now, if he did, that's not
I'm gonna disagree just now. I think he did it on purpose, trying to make a joke, and it fell flat because
he probably. Now that's true. That you know what? That's better than trying to rib him or trying to dig at him.
Yeah,
I think that there was some. He was maybe he was trying to bring in some levity into the into
maybe
the
it
booth,
was a
and it
producer
didn't, and it didn't work.
Producer who caught him like, hey, when you come back, you should you know. You know, this game does feel one-sided. Maybe even bring up a 28-3 reference.
Right, right, right. And he probably was like, "Man, this might be funny."
Yeah,
and it might open up Matt Ryan to be a little bit more humorous.
Like, and maybe that was the goal.
Makes a self-deprecating joke, and then you know, warms him up to the broadcast. He's probably nervous.
No, right? I guarantee you. Know, I mean, he looks shell-shocked when he's up, when he's doing the whole thing. And a lot of
athletes find this very, very stressful.
Yeah.
The broadcasting stuff.
Oh, God.
Some of them don't, but some of them do. It's not, they're like, they've been so accustomed to action, reaction, and their world of playing football, not broadcasting. And you got people in your head telling you what to say, not what to do. You know, where like Matt Ryan is used to a play coming in, and he know like, I used to play a game with this coach. We used to do this game in Colorado Springs. We had a Fisher DeBerry, and Fisher DeBerry had a Southern accent, which was even better. But what we would do is we recorded Fisher DeBerry saying a play, and then we would have listeners listen to the play, and then they would have to repeat it, what the play was. But with quarterbacks, they're not they can do that like that because they know all the plays, right? But when you're in broadcasting and they're like, talk about this, bring up this, and then after that, bring up this, it's like, hold on, this is a whole different world. So maybe he was really nervous and maybe he just didn't. But maybe Andrew Catalan should try it week 7 of the relationship. And let's see in week 7 or 8, maybe by that time they're clicking and their relationship is good. And then Matt Ryan will get the joke. Do you think at the hotel they're like, hey, man, I was trying to – all right, obviously you weren't paying attention, but that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Poor Matt Ryan.
That's because the only thing I got from him is like, I swear to God, that's what this guy's legacy is.
It's
– and it's horrible. Because, I mean, in all honesty, it wasn't really his fault.
It wasn't his fault.
It totally became the play calling because they went way too conservative where they were just taking it to
– and the defense should have done a little better job.
Yes.
By the way, Tom Brady got honored in New England. He went
Saw
nuts.
That.
They had a great time. Cheerleaders were all in their 12 jerseys, and everybody was losing their mind.
And
it was
I do appreciate Robert Kraft waiving tradition to induct him into the Hall of Fame next year.
Yeah.
And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I think there are certain players that come along that fit this unique bill of course he's going to be a Hall of Famer. Why wait?
Well, I don't think anybody is. I think the problem with it, let's find the real reason they're doing that. Because I don't think we're the
because
only
they
ones
probably
that
want
feel
him to
way.
Be recognized honestly, as a Patriot like, forever than a
no,
Buccaneer.
No. Like do we think like that when it comes to the Hall of Fame, like Canton or baseball, do you think that they disagree with that? Like do you think that they disagree with us on that?
No.
Like do you think somebody in the Baseball Hall of Fame committee goes, Derek Jeter, no, we need 5 years. We need 60 months. They're probably like, no, he should go in. But we do it for this reason. And I'd like to kind of know what that reason is.
Yeah.
Because I'm with you.
Because there's only been one player in history that.
Now, when it comes to team Hall of Fames, there's no rule. It's whatever the owner wants. He can do whatever he
wants. It was Patriot tradition.
Yeah, Patriot tradition, but the owner can do whatever he wants. That's he runs the show.
Yeah.
But the big committees, why do they keep a guy 5 years? Before they get in. That's silly. You're right. That is silly. We'll continue. Jared Dubin next.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, we're heading to the Progressive guest line, Progressive Insurance. Round out your protection with life, phone, and pet insurance. Jared Dubin set to join us from CBS Sports to talk week 1 in the NFL. Again, week 1, some of the games are sloppy. Some of the games, you know, you're working out some stuff. Some teams didn't look as sharp. Some teams did look sharp. Plus, we got a Monday night game where Aaron Rodgers and the Jets will take on Buffalo. Jared, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
All right. I don't want to overreact to anything, but what were some of the things that were surprising to you in week one?
The Bengals offense completely self-destructing against the Browns. I know some of that has to do with the weather there in Ohio, and some of it has to do with the fact that Joe Burrow obviously sat out almost all of training camp with that calf injury, and he didn't, I think, look physically right. But, you know, Cleveland's defense, I think a lot of people expected to be better this year, including myself, but I'd also expected that in each of, like, the last 3 years from the Browns, and it hadn't happened before. But the way that that Cincinnati offense just got completely shut down was probably the most surprising thing to me.
Yeah, you always have to throw in the caveat with the rain that happened in Cleveland, but how much – I mean, Joe Burrow didn't look like he was fit to play fully. Was it still a good idea, though, to just see what he would do in week one?
Yeah, I mean, if you think he's healthy enough to play, like, he's obviously the guy that gives you the best chance to win. Like, I don't know that – I'm not a doctor, obviously. I don't know if there was any more risk to him by being out there than there would have been if they held him out for, you know, another week or something like that. But yeah, he didn't look like himself, obviously. And, you know, we don't know how much of that is the injury, how much of that is the weather, how much of that is just, you know, Cleveland's defense played really, really well. Jim Schwartz did a great job putting those guys up front in particular in position to succeed, moving Myles Garrett around, using Za'Darius Smith in a bunch of different ways. And that group just sort of dominated.
All right, the 49ers beating the Steelers is not a surprise in and of itself, but were you surprised that the Steelers, who were getting some love, preseason, whatever people want to take out of that, looked effective in the first-team offense, that they just absolutely threw out a nothing out there at Acushnet Stadium?
No. Like, I tend to be – I think there are very few people in the world that put less stock in preseason football than I do. So I did not really come in with the same sort of expectations of the Pittsburgh offense that people did, just because I really just don't care what happens in preseason. It's barely real football. And they were playing against, you know, arguably the best defense in the league. And I think their offensive line in Pittsburgh, while it is probably improved, still is not very good. And even the, you know, the better performance we saw from Kenny Pickett over the second half of last season, I mean, he still had like a negative touchdown to interception ratio. He still wasn't pushing the ball down the field. Their running game, you know, still was not particularly efficient. Like, it was not all that surprising to me.
Do you think that attention that Pittsburgh was getting like late in August was more people going, we're talking about the same teams in the AFC. Let's just find another team that's different and maybe has a little hope? Because I'm with you. I think that the Steelers had a great second half of the season, but there were still plenty of problems with Kenny Pickett.
Yeah, I mean, some of it was almost certainly that, and some of it was, like, there are people that think the preseason matters. I'm just not one of them.
You
know, like, there are certainly people that think that it, you know, can tell you something about what's going to happen in the regular season. You know, to me, that is maybe more about player usage, like who's lining up with the starters and things like that, as opposed to, like, how players perform in the preseason. Just nobody's running their real stuff. If you have your starters out there, most of the time they're playing against second and third teamers. Like, it just is not indicative of what's going to happen in the regular season to me.
There's a cliche I use all the time. Don't be the guy that follows the guy. In Jordan Love's case, he's the guy that follows two guys. How did you think he did? Now is he taking over the reins of the Green Bay Packers?
Yeah, I thought he looked pretty good. You know, it's a Chicago defense that still is not particularly talented, and also I thought just played pretty badly. There were guys running open all over the field, and there were a couple of times where Love, like, threw falling backwards off of his back foot, sort of lollipopped it to guys who were, I mean, no one was within 20 yards of them. That's how much time he had to throw and how much space some of these guys had, but he did what he had to do. He threw for three touchdowns, I believe. He completed, you know, pretty decent set of percentage of his passes. Like, he didn't do anything to dissuade you from thinking he could be good the rest of the way. Obviously, we're going to have to see him play, you know, in a more competitive game against the defense with some more talent. But, you know, things were made, I thought, pretty easy for him, and he did well with that.
Did Tua Tagovailoa do anything different in the game against the Chargers that surprised us, or was this the quarterback we always knew was there, but last year his health became the overriding story?
I think that there were a few plays where he was creating stuff outside of the structure of the offense. A lot of times last year, it was, you know, Mike McDaniel scheming guys open and Tua throwing into these incredibly wide windows, you know, on time and in rhythm to these guys who were, you know, just so outrageously fast and being able to create yards after the catch. There were a few plays in this game, you know, one deep ball to Tyreek Hill that he threw, you know, sort of stepping up through the pocket on the run across the field from the left to the right. There was another one where he scrambled away from pressure, rolled out to his left and found Braxton Berrios for, you know, a pass on the move for a first down. There was a scramble that he had up the middle for, I think, like a 7-yard gain and a first down. All that kind of stuff is really encouraging because we didn't see that from him all that often last season. So being able to add that to his game just takes the offense to, you know, a whole other level.
Let's go to Denver. Russell Wilson and Sean Payton, this connection that's been made. Everyone's looking for a new Russell Wilson from last year. But we got the same result, which is a low-scoring offense. But did you see better Russell Wilson in this game?
Not really, honestly. Like,
yeah.
I think he threw like 35, 36 passes and for like 170-something yards. Like, he completed a higher percentage of his passes, but there was no really like pushing the ball down the field. It was a lot of, you know, shutting down, throwing behind the line of scrimmage, not really finding guys, you know, down the field or in tight windows or anything like that. Like, I think Sean Payton put him in better positions to succeed than the offense did last year, but he wasn't really able to do all that much with that.
We have such a long season, but in the end, there's always sloppy play in week one. How much of it do you take into account of when you want to make an analysis of a team? What's the preseason? Like, you talked about preseason. People put a lot of stock in it. Some people put no stock into it. Is it a preseason issue that we get some sloppiness, or we just do it every year no matter what?
Yeah, I think there's always going to be strange stuff that happens early in the season. There's also going to be strange stuff that happens late in the season. You know, like, sometimes good teams just come out and don't play well. Sometimes bad teams come out and play really well. Sometimes there's a matchup that just dramatically favors one team or the other. Sometimes there's weather. Sometimes there's injuries. Like, you're always going to get weird results in the NFL. It's a game with a very weird-shaped ball that
yeah.
You know, bounces in very funny ways, and sometimes things just happen.
Dallas Cowboys, if there was a statement made on their defense, how big was it, and how much does it say about the Giants on the other end?
I don't know if there was a statement made. I think we knew that this was what the Cowboys defense was going to be, right? Like, maybe
yeah.
not, you know, the best performance in the history of the Cowboys defense, like that. But we knew that once they get on top of you with a lead, like, that pass rush just comes in absolute waves. Like, the Eagles led the NFL in sacks last season, but Dallas led the NFL in pressure rate by, like, a significant margin. And that was the same thing last night. They pressured Daniel Jones on more than 60% of his dropbacks. And honestly, that number seems low. Like, it seemed pretty close to 100%. And it's just when they get a lead and you have to start dropping back all the time, there's not much hope for a passing game, especially when your offensive line is not very good. Like, the Giants offensive line isn't. I know that, you know, before the game on NBC, they were talking about how the talent gap between the Cowboys and the Eagles and the Giants had narrowed in the offseason. I think we saw that is, you know, not the case. Like, Dallas was already significantly better than the Giants last year and added Brandon Cooks and Stephon Gilmore in the offseason and got Tyron Smith back from injury. Like, the gap, I don't think, really narrowed between those teams. Philly and Dallas are still pretty clearly the class of that division and two of the three best teams in the NFC.
All right, real quick, I got 60 seconds. Your thoughts tonight? I know it's going to be Rodgers and a lot of attention there, but what do you think tonight between the Bills and the Jets?
Yeah, I'm really interested to see if Josh Allen can play better against the Jets than he did last year. That first game against New York was the game where he got that elbow injury, but I'm curious to see how often they work in Dalton Kincaid as a slot receiver and how often they move Stephon Diggs into the slot because they want to avoid those perimeter corners, and they lined him up inside much more often against the Jets last year than against everybody else.
Jared Dubin, you're the best. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much, as always.
Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
Jared Dubin, CBS Sports. Guys, we quickly go through some of the games in week one. Yeah, I'm kind of with them. Like, there's sloppiness, but you can expect that too later in the season as well. But the Rams, And he scored 23 points in the second half against the Seahawks on five drives. And as I mentioned earlier, 400 yards of total offense. They might be okay. Not great, but okay. And in the NFC, okay might be all right. We'll continue. It's Wake Up Call, Hour 3 coming up next.